I guess as we start to wrap up, we'll mention again that the event is on Saturday, October 14th, and it's at the Rose City Park Presbyterian Church. And is there anything you want to add?
Well, I'd like to tell you where the Rose City Park Presbyterian Church is. It's right off Sandy at between 44th and 45th. The entrance is at 44th. So it is right next, right across the street from the Hollywood Farmers Market. Really easy to find. There's a lot of good transit there. If you want to get in really early and you are in a car, you might want to come a little extra early to find parking because of the farmers market. But we really hope people come. The best way to build our community is to understand our community and know about it.
And that stand together under one roof. So Bonnie, yeah, thanks for coming by the station.
Thank you, Kabu.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMiniman's Mission Theater in Portland. Radiance of Resistance is an award-winning documentary that tells the story of two youths who have become global ambassadors for Palestinian human rights. The film is an intimate look at their everyday lives and roles as part of a new generation of Palestinian civil rights leaders. Again, that's Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMiniman's Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Time is 6:03 and you're listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up next, Preference Radio.
Hello, dear listeners. Thanks for tuning in. This is Preference and Experiment Radio. Here on KBOO, we are happy to have you. Before I launch into today's program, I want to remind you that we are doing Thriller World. We're going to dress up as zombies all together with folks around the world at the same time. Midday, Saturday, October 28th. We'd love to have you. We'd love to teach you how to do the Thriller Dance and have you join us as zombie dancers. This is a benefit this year for KBOO and Portland Tenants United. My name's Alan. This is Preference, and I believe we have Toby Hillmeyer on the line.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Toby. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Just got off of work.
Well, welcome. I'm glad to have you. Have you been on cable before, Toby?
Yeah, about a year ago, I think.
Mm-hmm. So why don't we start today, Toby, by having you give a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, so my name's Toby Hillmeyer. I'm a trans author and activist, and I do a lot of different things. One of the big things I'm talking about right now is a book that I recently released back in February, Nerve Endings, The New Trans Erotic, which is a collection of short stories that follows trans experiences of sex, sexuality, and erotica. And it kind of has a wide range of what that means to people. There's some things that people might typically expect from an erotic anthology, and there's a lot of other things that get in depth in different ways, like one story about a pregnant trans man dealing with prepartum depression, and another one about a trans woman who's trying to raise her orphaned nephew in a zombie apocalypse. Just kind of a wide range of being able to tell people's stories, because I believe that talking about sexuality really requires a holistic look at all of our experiences.
And this is from Instar Books.
Yes, that's right.
Wonderful. Now, are any of these folks who contributed to Nerve Endings, The New Trans Erotic, are they Northwest, Pacific Northwest folks?
They're all around the country and the world. There's someone from New Zealand, one from the UK, a couple of people from Canada, and then folks all around the US.
You yourself, you're from Seattle? Is that where you're living?
That's right. Yeah. Although I grew up in Eugene, so I'm used to Oregon.
What was Eugene like when you were younger?
It was very, very white. It's actually slightly less white now, but I remember, like, when I was growing up, I saw some statistic that it was 95% white, which was a little bit of a struggle for me growing up in some ways, but there were definitely things that I appreciated about it. I've still got family there, and I go visit sometimes.
How was that a struggle for you to have to be growing up in an environment?
Yeah,
that's...
well, so I guess to tell you a bit about my family, I have lesbian moms, and because of the donor they used, I'm the only person in my family who's a person of color. Mm-hmm. My parents are white, my brother's white, my donor is a person of color, and that makes me mixed race, and. Then growing up in a neighborhood that was really white, going to a school that was really white, it really set an awkward and interesting kind of setup for my own racial identity development. And I'll tell you, I remember being in college and hearing from a lot of people in the LGBTQ groups that I went to that they felt sometimes like communities of color had a familial response to racism that they lacked, and they had to kind of like build for themselves and having to learn how to deal with homophobia. For me, it was the other way around. Like, I've been learning how to deal with homophobia since I was 3, but I didn't really have an understanding of what it meant to be a person of color in this world until I was at least in my teens.
Did you end up going to college in Eugene?
Yeah, I did. I went to University of Oregon.
I saw that you told me that you were working on the against the OCA, the Oregon Citizens Alliance campaigns.
Yeah. You know, they had the infamous Measure 913 and Measure 9 again, and I was around for all three of those.
Do you think? I think it might be easy for a lot of folks who are recent to Portland or the Portland area, of which there are many, may not understand the sense in which I think Oregon is was or maybe is mostly a rural state with perhaps some strong rural sensibilities, which made those anti-gay measures one and again you know, narrow wins at election time.
Yeah, and I can't tell you how much I have a sensation right now of history repeating itself. I moved to Washington, and now we're dealing with statewide ballot measures, which we've been lucky to keep off the ballot so far, but like wide sweeping anti-trans ballot measures that that we have to put a lot of energy into to fighting, because there's a very real chance that they could pass. And it definitely feels like very much the same kind of thing of when I was growing up dealing with the anti-gay and lesbian ballot initiatives of Oregon.
So these are statewide efforts to create these anti-trans...
both this year and last year, they narrowly missed having enough signatures to go on to the ballot. And I think that is because we've been there fighting them from day one rather than just waiting for them to have to turn in their signatures. But they would actually go back and repeal the statewide non-discrimination law that we have. We passed about 12 years ago now, that was the statewide non-discrimination law around gender identity and sexual orientation. And, you know, we've had it for well over a decade now, but it's still at risk. And it's wild to me, you know, growing up in my civics class, I could kind of understand why some people didn't have rights and needed to fight for them. But I never anticipated that people could fight for their rights, win their rights, and then later have their rights be taken away.
Mm-hmm. That's a I think that's a sort of sensation that folks are having. A lot of folks are having to deal with. Do you have some sort of I don't want to call it a theory of history or something that. That elaborate, but do you have some sense, some greater sense of how nothing for the rest of our lives and for beyond will ever be stable, and that we'll always be fighting this fight or another fight, that once we attempt to claim space that's ours, somebody always will want to claim it for their own?
I mean, you know, there is the theory of this kind of like linear progression of human rights, the idea that the arc of history is long but bends towards justice. And I think that there is some truth to that, but a lot of people put more credit into that than it's worth. Where I hear some people who will sometimes say like, oh yeah, you just need to wait your turn for your rights, but you know, we don't get rights because time passes. We get rights because people have been fighting for them for a very long time. So if everyone decided to just sit and wait and do nothing, then nothing would happen. And the only reason why the arc of history bends towards justice is because there's a lot of people pushing to make that be reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires people in order to do that.
Toby, what are you working on in Seattle these days?
Yeah, I'm the communications director at Gay City, Seattle's LGBTQ center, and through there I also coordinate the End AIDS Washington outreach and promotion campaign. So there's a lot of exciting stuff going on with that, and one of the things, actually, I was just posting this to our Facebook today, just recently the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, came out and said some big news around HIV, which is that if someone has HIV and they're on treatment and able to maintain an undetectable viral load, there's effectively no risk of transmitting the virus to a partner, which is really huge to consider the implications of that. And it's a big part of what we're talking about around the End AIDS Washington campaign. There's a similar campaign happening in many different states, and I know that actually one of our partner organizations is based in Portland, the Cascade AIDS Project, and being able to talk about like what it means for people to be able to be on PrEP and effectively not be able to get HIV, and for people who have HIV to be on treatment and if your viral load is undetectable, effectively not be able to transmit HIV. And it's those kinds of medical advances that are allowing us to look at a game plan for what it would take to actually end AIDS.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Now I want to hear about this play.
Oh yeah. So I did also tell you about a play that I'm working on.
Oh, yeah.
In addition to my day job, I try to do one major project per year, and last year it was Nerve Endings, and this year I'm working on a one-woman play about a trans superhero turned villain who tries to take over the world, and it looks like it will be premiering that in May in Seattle, and I'm really excited about that.
Wonderful. Can you give us a hint, maybe just a hint, about what...
Yeah, so one of the major themes that happens in the play is kind of the kind of struggle around reform versus revolt as how people make change. Kind of essentially, do you stay with a system that you know is unjust because you hope to try and affect it from within and eventually make things better? Or do you tear down the system completely to rebuild it? And actually, that is one of the things that happens towards the end. Eventually, the main character is in a position to be able to take over the world and, you know, in all the supervillain ways, destroy the world's systems of government and power to try and start over, and then the audience has to convince her whether or not the death toll is worth it to take over the world, or if it would be better to have a slower, steadier change from within.
Wonderful. Oh, looking forward to seeing how that comes out.
The title of the play is Fallen Star.
Mm. So let us talk some more. We're talking, listeners, with Toby Hillmeyer, among many other things, editor of Nerve Endings, the new trans erotic, an anthology released this year by Instar Books.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk more about it. How did this come to be? How did this come to be last year's project for you?
Yeah, I've been wanting to have an erotic anthology around trans experiences for a long time, because so much of the media out there that deals with trans people's sexuality has been created by cis people, by people who aren't trans, by people who are essentially building off of stereotypes and tropes. And I wanted to kind of get an opportunity to really flush out a more whole and authentic experience of what sexuality can mean to trans people, and have different stories that kind of touch on all of the kinds of things, from dealing with past trauma and sexual assault, to how, like, what makes partners supportive, or what kinds of common dynamics are really unsupportive in relationships that trans people experience. And ultimately ended up with 30 stories that really have a wide range of settings. 10 of them are sci-fi, fantasy, speculative fiction, and really use that as an opportunity to kind of go out of this world to deal with some very familiar and sometimes intense situations that some can be a little bit easier to deal with when it's, you know, outside of this world setting. And kind of one of the thoughts that I had guiding me in this project was, you know, a lot of people are turning to different forms of media as escapism, especially now. And I feel that a lot of escapism out there is imagining a world where we don't have the problems that we're facing. But I wanted to create escapism where all of our problems still exist, but we have the power to overcome them.
Do you feel like this anthology covered that sensibility, or do you have, a next one in mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely did hit that, in that, you know, I put into the call for submissions that I didn't want people to be limited by needing a happy ending, or feeling like certain subjects were off topic because they're too sad or difficult. And so there's definitely a lot of stories that deal with very difficult and sad subjects. Mm-hmm. For the most part, I tried to find things that had some sort of optimism point, or some like path towards growth around these kinds of things, but also at the same time, being seen in all of who you are is a huge way to kind of like address and be able to overcome some of the kinds of difficulties that we all face in life. And so even when there wasn't necessarily a happy ending, being able to like have a story that is talking about overcoming triggers from childhood sexual assault, or dealing with hookups and relationships with people who might not respect you the way you deserve to be respected, that even just by taking the space to address and kind of be like, these are real experiences that we're all dealing with, and give space to kind of show different ways that people can deal with them, is really powerful. And I've definitely heard from a lot of folks who have read the book, and you know, one of the things I've heard from some people is that it sometimes can get pretty intense, and it might be like you read a story and you set it down and like think about it and absorb it for a while before diving into the next story, but that ultimately it can be really affirming and powerful to kind of see your experiences reflected that way, and have like opportunities for how we deal with and grow and overcome all of these different kinds of problems around transphobia and violence.
How long did it take from beginning to end? And there probably wasn't a single beginning, and there probably isn't a single end, but to put this on a shelf, what does that take?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would say I had been contemplating it for close to a decade, mm-hmm. so I had a decent amount of thought that went into how I would do it, mm-hmm. but when I finally decided I was going to do it, it came together really quickly. It was October, about 2 years ago. Yeah, October 2 years ago when I first, approached the publisher in Star Books and asked if they would want to work on this project with me. And then I dove into putting together a call for submissions and then started collecting submissions for about 6 to 9 months. And then I spent like 3 more months reading submissions and choosing which ones to include, and then another 3 months editing those submissions and getting everything put together, and then another 2 or 3 months putting together a Kickstarter campaign and preparing for the book launch. So the whole thing was about a year and a half.
It seems like it was pretty speedy.
Yeah. and I definitely got like a really strong response, and I think that that shows a little bit of how much trans literature is really, people are hungry for trans literature, mm-hmm. and an opportunity to have their work out there. And I was able to get like 80 something submissions, which was, you know, a lot to read through. But I was really excited to have that many submissions so that I wasn't just going to be choosing the 30 stories that were worthy of being published, but I was able to, you know, pick and choose and balance a little bit the balance of how many stories were, you know, had happy endings versus sad endings, how many stories dealt with trans men and trans women and non-binary individuals, and the how many stories included characters of color and people with disabilities and different things like that.
Do you have a design on a press tour that might bring you or authors through Portland?
You know, I had a plan for doing a book tour, but then I ended up getting a full-time job, and that plan kind of went out the window. I've done a few different events in New York and Oakland and here in Seattle, but I haven't really been able to do much beyond that. What I am going to be able to do coming up soon is I'm also a part of, I'm a contributor to an upcoming anthology, the Resilience Anthology, which is actually currently on Kickstarter. And it's the largest literary collection of transgender women and male-assigned non-binary writers. And it's gotten a great response so far and actually got some donors who are going to help make it possible for that anthology to mm-hmm. do a small book tour in Minneapolis and Chicago coming up in December. And so I'm going to be a part of that, where I'll be sharing my writing in that anthology, but also just talking about my work in general and definitely bringing copies of Nerve Endings to sell while I'm there.
Sure. And you were at Butch Voices in Oakland, right?
Yes, that's right. So I have to kind of like overlap my readings with other travel that I'm set up to do. And I was traveling down to Oakland for the Butch Voices conference. So I arranged to do a reading while I was down there.
Yeah, a friend of mine heard that reading and suggested that I get in touch with you for preference.
Cool. Yeah.
So. Wonderful. And I believe we're having Gabby Rivera, who was also presenting at Butch Voices. I believe she's calling in just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is our plan. It says here in what you sent me that you're also an advocate for sex worker rights. We talk about those issues a fair amount on Preference over the last couple of years. And I was even listening to a couple of folks on the bus yesterday talking about condoms as evidence. Especially for trans people who are targeted by police, pulled over on the street, so to speak.
Yeah, that's one of the things where in many areas it's common practice for police to have you know, the fact that you're carrying condoms be evidence of engaging in sex work. And, you know, in reality, not everybody who has a handful of condoms in their backpack is going to be arrested for prostitution. And it's instead going to be a way for the police to, you know, have their biases and profiling. And usually that does look like trans women who are visible as trans women, especially trans women of color, being stopped and harassed by police. And if they have condoms on them, that alone can be enough to have them end up with a night in jail. Mm-hmm. It's pretty terrible, especially since, you know, a big part of my work is around like HIV and safe sex, that for the government to basically say, like, if you don't want to go to jail, don't carry condoms on you. Mm-hmm. Especially for a population that has such a high HIV rate, it's just abhorrent for the government to be engaging in that kind of a practice.
Yeah, indeed. We are speaking with Toby Hillmeyer, Seattle-based, and editor of the new book, Nerve Endings, The New Trans Erotic. We also have Gabby Rivera on the telephone line. Gabby, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Hello.
Hi there. Welcome.
Hi.
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 Toby, you are welcome to stay on the line with us if you like.
Sure, I can stick around a while.
Okay. Gabby, thanks for joining us. We've spent a long time trying to set this up. I'm very excited that we made it work. So welcome, and how are you?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Excuse me, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Do you want to give us a little brush on your background?
Yeah, sure. My name is Gabby Rivera, pronouns she, her. I am a queer Latinx writer from the Bronx. I'm a young adult novelist. My first YA novel, Juliet Takes a Breath, was published in January 2016. I'm currently writing for Marvel Comics. Mm-hmm. I'm writing America, the America Chavez solo series. Yeah, and I'm just kind of like a big nerd burger.
Well, Juliet Takes a Breath is a young Bronx Latina woman who comes out and finds out what Portland's version of white feminism looks like.
Yes, she does.
It reminds me of Jamie Beru's book, Portland Diary 2016-2017. A trans woman comes to Portland and struggles with everyone's hyper good intentions. And I've read this book twice, and I've encouraged everyone I know to read it. And I have either laughed or wept, and sometimes both, through quite a bit of the book.
Oh, I'm so glad.
On both readings. It just repeatedly pokes at me in heart spots. So I'd love to hear how this book came to be, you know. I think there's
It's like its own, I mean, I just had never read anything like that before, you know what I mean? And that's like, you know, like, in its own right, like a feminist statement of the time, right? This book. Mm-hmm. And so I like went to Portland and did an internship with her. But I just thought that was like me living like a wild life, you know, like I'm gonna do what I want. Like I like perform poetry. Anyway, long story short, somebody encouraged me to write about my time in Portland, being somebody like from the Bronx and queer and all of these things. And so it originally was a short story in Ariel Gore's anthology Portland Queer. Mm-hmm. Ariel Gore is like one of my writing mentors. She's like published like a billion times over. And so yeah, from there it just kind of like somebody was like, hey, if you turn that book, Portland Queer won a Lambda, and I read an excerpt from Juliet, and somebody was like, if you write a novel, I will publish you. So I was like, okay. You know what I mean? Like, I just thought I did. And I wrote about what it was like.
How has it been received, Juliet Takes a Breath?
Juliet's been enveloped in this really, like, delicious, like, community hug kind of love situation, right? Like, well, when it first came out, it was heavily, like, supported by, like, queer, lesbian, like, communities of color and, like, and just everybody, right? So Auto Shadow was a huge support of Juliet Takes a Breath. Like, I used to write for them. Mm-hmm. And it just was this book that people, like, kind of like what you said, they liked reading it a lot and they connected with it, but they also wanted to, like, kick it out to other people and share it with folks, you know? And I'm pretty much was on, like, an indie publisher, and it felt like my community just really rallied behind this book and wrote about it. And yeah, so that's the response, kind of. Like, I feel like everyone's had a hand in, like, protecting this book and elevating it.
Mm-hmm. The publisher is Riverdale Avenue Books. It's really been great in developing this radio show to learn about so many great smaller publishing houses putting out great work, and Riverdale is one of them, and InStar is another. So that's been really great for me.
Right.
Yeah. And I'd love to say I picked up a copy of it after seeing you at Butch Voices, and then went on a camping trip with my partners, and every night when we got into the tent, we would, like, read it out loud to each other.
What?
And we just devoured that whole book in that camping trip. And it was just, it was incredible, because, like, we'd all grown up, two of us had grown up in Oregon, and one of us had, like, moved to Portland and lived there for a while, and there was just so much in there that is just that like, face palming, I know exactly what that is like, and it was really awesome to see it reflected that way.
Oh my goodness, that's so beautiful to hear, though. Thank you for sharing that too. Like,
thank you.
Man, we know each other then? If you were at Butch Voices conference, right? Like,
we didn't get a chance to talk one-on-one, but we were in a workshop together, and then also, I definitely saw you around.
Okay, well, next time we're going to have to, like, say hello. I'm a big hugger. We don't have to hug, but, like, the offer's there.
yeah.
All right, Juliet Takes a Breath. Let's see. This is probably a terrible question, but is there anyone who, anyone who inspired Harlow in particular, or is Harlow just perhaps white, self-entitled, head in the clouds feminism that perhaps meets some folks' needs really well and lots of others not so well?
I mean, Harlow is definitely based on some folks that I know, right? Mm-hmm. And that I've, like, loved in the way that you love somebody who is, like, a mentor to you. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the quote-unquote, like, real Harlow. And I, like, did not ever experience that type of racial, like, exchange or interaction that Juliet and Harlow do, but I have experienced that from other folks, and so I figured, why not that make this character, that's, like, the perfect vehicle to discuss the, like, grappling that folks are doing, trying to like disentangle like white supremacy from feminism, right? Like, how can we talk about that on a very human level? You know, it's so much more complicated to talk about that sort of thing too. Like, you know, the bigger issues like racism and ableism and transphobia and all these things with like folks that you actually love. You know, like when folks you love are engaging in behavior that is like, woof, like harmful in so many ways, that's the hardest to like pinpoint, and that's the hardest to experience, you know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, to love Harlow just the way that like I've loved folks like her, and also bring in this like other element, you know?
Certainly it can be tough when we in certain ways outgrow our mentors. And we want to start to tug them along, and maybe they're not the quickest to want to do that, you know.
It's hard sometimes, though, right? I feel like I hate the term like LGBT community because we're all so different, right? But like in this community of communities, I often feel like if and when we do get to like have elders that reach a certain age and they're thriving and they're like here, sometimes they like they maybe not like where we would like them to be politically, right? Or like in their understanding of certain like newer terms or terminologies. And so sometimes I wonder like, how do we engage folks? How do we make sure that we don't discard people? How do we make sure that we do when it's necessary, you know? Anyway.
Yeah, I think that's entirely reasonable. What do we want from our... What do we want from our elders? What do we need from them? And what do they need from us? In terms of...
What do they need from us is a really good question, too.
In terms of how we structure and shape community. And really, we are... I suppose this may be the first time in at least a very long time that we can begin to point to people and say these are our queer elders or these are our trans elders or this conversation in particular I think is really new, and you know just at the very beginning of it. I want to talk about Little Melvin.
Yeah.
We don't spend much time with him, but he glows in this book. We should all have such openly loving siblings. who are...
Yeah, Little Melvin. What were you going to say?
And still are their own, you know, weirdo, quirky... You know, freaks in their own ways, you know.
Little Melvin is based off of my brother. Me and my brother have like 5 years between us, and so my brother was definitely like the little chubby cutie boy eating snacks and like reading Animorphs in my room. I think I was more of a mean big sister. Julia's really nice to him. But he was just always so gentle and soft. And I think there's some portrayal of that now with, like, Modern Family, where Manny, especially when he was younger, was very, like, gentle and, like, you know, kind of like this romantic character, right? But with Little Melvin, you get this, like, geeky sensitivity, which I felt was important, especially because one of the only other portrayals of Latino, like, teenage boys is a group of boys that corner Juliet in a supermarket. Mm-hmm. And they, like, make lewd gestures towards her, right? And in my mind, it was like, well, I need to be responsible in my portrayal of folks and remember to highlight that, like, that's just one, you know, that's just one example of Latino boys. We need to be able to see that they can be nerdy, geeky, like, soft, gentle humans as well. And I just loved writing Little Melvin. I wanted to make sure to show that, like, he supports his sister 100% and that he's on his own like queer little journey, and even in his like shyness or his awkwardness, he's so confident, right? Like, he's so confident that he like sticks up to his aunt that's a cop while she's telling this story about chasing down criminals, mm-hmm. right? And he's so unimpressed, you know? He's like, well, are you a Falcon? Well, then he's like, you have a gun, who cares? You know, he's still able to kind of hold his own in so many situations. He's yeah. like the low-key, like, queer people favorite, Little Melvin.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not the first to point to Little Melvin and say, there's a star.
No, but it is nice to hear.
We're talking with...
And it's fun. I like knowing what people like. You know what I mean? I love hearing that.
Yeah. We're talking with Gabby Rivera, author of Juliet Takes a Breath and current writer of America. We'll talk about America in a moment. I have another question about Juliet. Were you surprised when she decided to go back to Portland to finish up the summer?
Was I surprised? No way. Like, she is, like, sticks to her word, and she's got, like, a work ethic kind of that there's no way that she was gonna, like, leave that unsettled, you know? Like, even the way that, like, her parents kind of were, like, strict and religious, like, that would have, she was always gonna go back and kind of make sure she finished what she started. And especially, like, figure out what was really going on with Harlow.
Fortunately, she has other folks in Portland to balance out her experience, and not have her just think that the rest of the world is going to treat her the way that Harlow does.
No, right? Like, there's a whole crew of folks that are supporting Juliet, and that's important too, right? You know, like, a lot of times, especially when it comes to stories about folks that are, like, obsessed with somebody, it's just, like, this one-on-one person. But I've always experienced, and even in my own writing spaces, there are, like, communities of women and communities of like, people of color that are supporting us, right? So Juliet has that in Maxine and Zyra, and she also has it in Miami with her family.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, like, at every point that she experiences growth from outside of herself, then she must also experience that growth within her own folks and her own, like, her own world too, you know?
One of the things that really moved me about this book is that it was, you know, by necessity and by design, it's a distilled version of a coming out process, you know, which can take years and many conversations and, you know, a lot of all sorts of things. And here we got, we got one summer of this young woman's life, and one kind of, not just one, but several pieces of what coming out might look like. And there's something so wonderful about hearing Juliet essentially launch the book and the story by saying, "Hey, I'm queer. There's this lady. Let's put that on the table and talk about what it means for us." And I think there's a directness in Juliet about it, that, you know, even whatever anxiety or fear that she felt, she still just did it. You know, okay, I'm leaving tomorrow, but I need you to know this before I go. So, and I think so often it's not so clear cut, and it's so confusing, and it can be hard to, it can also be really hard to go in one straight line with it, you know, kind of comes in and out as you sort out who you want to tell and what. And so I appreciated being able to come along with Juliet while she sorted out those questions and how to communicate with the people around her who she is.
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely. I just, I wanted her to feel proud of it, you know, like, and experience, like, the fun, like, acknowledge the fun and the electricity when you finally, like, you know, not finally, because it's not for everybody, right? You don't have to, like, subscribe to any label ever. You don't ever have to, like, come out in any way. But, like, if that's the choice that you make and something does fit and you do want to come out, I wanted to highlight the part where it would feel exciting, you know, where your attraction and being able to, like, experience that and experience this new part of yourself where there was joy there. And I hadn't really read anything like that, like where it starts with, I am this, it is happening, boom, let's go. Like, I don't feel bad. I've wallowed already. We're at the point where I am just done wallowing, like, take it or leave it, you know? Mm-hmm. And also, like, it's just a piece of the story, you know? Like, we get to move forward and see her be, like, cute with librarians, you know? We get to, like, move forward in the story, and she can even heal from a breakup. You know, like, we get to do other things.
Yeah. It was nice for me. I moved here 25 years ago this summer. Measure 9, as Toby remembers. And I forget, you know, I forget most of what I experienced when I first, I didn't know anything about Portland at all. I knew less about Portland than Juliet did when I moved here. and so everything was uncolored by any expectations, or any design for me. So how things smelled and how people talked and what they wanted and where quiet existed, all of those things were for me to uncover for myself. And it was nice for a moment to see that, just that through somebody else's eyes.
Yeah, and it's like the opposite story. I mean, I feel like we usually get folks coming from other places and moving to New York. And adjusting to that, like, big city life. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, for me, it was a wildly new environment coming from the Bronx and going to Portland. So I tried to remember the things that stuck out to me as well.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, what were you here in Portland for?
Oh, my goodness. I did an internship. Similar to Juliet. I was on an internship with a feminist author, yeah.
All right. let's talk about America.
Let's do.
Yeah. So this is a series coming out from Marvel. And
it's out.
It is out. Yeah. I've seen 9 issues, I think. But there could be more that I just haven't come across.
I think 8 dropped today or this week. Or it's about to drop, but we definitely have all 7 out right now. Not all 7, but 7 mm-hmm. Came out, and yeah, we're on 8 now.
Folks, you can go find Gabby Rivera's America at Things from Another World in Northeast Portland.
Cool.
So tell us.
Hey.
Yeah. so what's going on in America? Who is she? Who is America Chavez?
Oh my goodness. America Chavez is a portal punching. She's so strong that she can punch through and into other dimensions, and the shape of her portals are stars. So that's like one of her most major superpowers. She's hella strong. She can heal. She can run fast. She can basically beat anybody at anything. She's like been part of the Marvel Universe for about 6 years, so I didn't create her. I was brought on to lead her solo series. She is an orphan. Her moms, like, sacrificed their lives to close the rips in the utopian parallel, and as they sacrificed themselves, little America fled and was sealed off from her homeland forever. So it's also the story of a young woman who cannot go home and has the ability to go wherever she wants, but like no place is her home, and she doesn't have any family. So she's been in different, she's in the Teen Brigade, the Ultimates, the Young Avengers, and now in this series, we've got her going to Sotomayor, Sonia Sotomayor University. Attempting to have a regular first year of undergrad. We see that that's impossible. because the forces align against her, and so she's, she finds herself having to take down some intergalactic energy monsters. She teams up with some sorority members, and she just generally has a kick-ass time.
Does she have romance?
America Chavez is also wild, right? Because she's like the first Latina, lesbian, like superhero ever. She had a girlfriend, this really sweet paramedic from New York, Lisa. But I don't know, what fun is that? You gotta like shake things up. So they don't make it through to the series. But we do see ex-girlfriends pop up from the past. We do get America in some pretty cool boxing matches, like motorcycles, wild friendship with Kate Bishop, Hawkeye, trips to Vegas, you know? There's a lot going on.
Yeah. How long does this series last, do you know?
Well, it's one of those things where it's like, like any kind of like TV show or something, it's pretty much ongoing until either like somebody moves on or like something changes. So she's a new character. So folks are just trying to see like, well, where do we go? What do we do? What's the best? Right now I'm doing like one arc at a time. You know what I mean? So we got our first arc. We did the two episode one-off with Kate Bishop and America. Number 7 was the origin issue. Have you checked out number 7?
I have it in my hands. I have not yet begun it.
Oh, my goodness. That one is like, if the universe was like, Gabby, in your wildest dreams, come up with the like most spiritual, beautiful, like wild origin mythological story you could come up with and put it in a comic, that is what number 7 is. I had so much fun writing that. 5, 6, and 7 are like my favorites.
The coloring in number 7 is amazing.
Jen Bartle is, oh my God, I'm screaming. Wait, let me try again. Jen Bartle is amazing. Ming Doyle and a bunch of other folks came in and did work on number 7, and it's just, the palette is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. The inking, the purples on that are just, oh my goodness, so dreamy. I screamed.
Well, what's next? Is there a sequel for Juliet?
Ooh. What is next? I have, like, tons more stories in me. I'm, like, trying my hand at the Juliet screenplay. You know, I'm working on a second book, but also I'm like open to so many things. I've got like a million and one stories in me, and I want to like tell all of them, you know.
I absolutely look forward to hearing at least a few more.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Gabby, for joining us today. Juliet Takes a Breath, out from Riverdale Avenue Books, and it's wonderful. And the America Chavez series with Marvel. Toby, are you still with us?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to make sure to thank you as well for joining us. Toby is the editor of Nerve Endings, the new trans erotic, as well as a community organizer in Seattle. And author of an upcoming one-woman play about a trans superhero turned villain.
Yeah.
Toby, Gabby, thanks so much for joining us today. It's very much been a pleasure.
Definitely.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. Take care.
All right. Good night, y'all.
Bye.
Bye. You have been listening to Preference Radio here on KBOO. I just want to remind you that upcoming is Thrill the World Portland. We were lucky enough to do this as a benefit for SMRC for 10 years this year. KBOO and Portland Tenants United will be our beneficiaries. We will teach you how to do the Thriller Dance, and then we'll gather together with zombies around the world at the same time on Saturday 28th to do the dance together. We usually average about 200 folks a year in Portland. And this year's dance is dedicated to Jamila Bourdon. She was our lead dancer for the last 9 years. She was also a host of an amazing program on KBOO called Guess Who's Coming to Radio. And she moved back to the East Coast very recently, and so we'll miss the dance this year. We miss her, and we're going to dedicate this year's Thrill the World to her. It's a benefit for KBOO and Portland Tenants United, and look for us online, Thrill the World Portland. Come and get your zombie on, get your dancing on, and have some fun with us. This has been Preference. I'm Alan, and coming up next, Hard Knock Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Stand Together Under One Roof on Saturday, October 14th, Rose City Park Presbyterian Church in Portland. Stand Together Under One Roof brings together multiple groups that work for social, racial, and environmental justice to share their purpose, projects, and stories. The day will include short sessions from a variety of groups, a panel, organizational tabling, discussions, networking, and music. Again, that's Stand Together Under One Roof on Saturday, October 14th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Rose City Park Presbyterian Church, 1907 Northeast 45th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.